Okay, we're going to get started. Just so we kind of stay on the schedule and make sure the trains run on time. First of all, I wanted to thank everybody for making it out here. I know it's painful to show up anywhere at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and we thank you for being here. Reed Smith could not be happier to host the event with this distinguished and fine-looking panel. So we're all very excited for different reasons. When Will approached me originally about this panel, I thought, my God, what a fantastic opportunity to be here before you and talk about some really practical and exciting stuff that I think would benefit everybody in this room who's a practitioner, regardless of whether you're in-house or external, particularly working with one of the foremost arbitrating forums in the world, such as CPR. But my excitement was short-lived, and I'll tell you why. Let's go back a couple of months ago when I was entrusted with putting together a different arbitration panel on international arbitration, and many of the friendly faces that you see in this panel were present on that panel because I invited them. They were very gracious to say yes, and at the last second, I had an emergency motion in Lima and had to leave them high and dry for the presentation. So you can imagine how I cringed to see their names here as part of this panel, and I hope that they've forgiven me.
No.
Clearly not. So really, what turned from a very joyous occasion potentially to now me trying to save my reputation from being sullied from what you're about to hear from these panelists. You know the truth of why I'm up here speaking to you, but really we're very, very happy to be here and to have you all with us, so many friendly faces. We're very excited. I wanted to particularly thank Alberto Ravel and Olivier for putting together this wonderful panel and for taking the time to organize it. It's never easy. Will's done a ton of work.
Will,
we really do appreciate it. We really do, because it's wonderful to give us a chance to get together. The panel's fantastic. Liz, Teresa, Alberto, good friend Jean. I think you're going to take a lot from this, more than just the CLE credit that you'll get at the end. And so I'd like to express particularly my thanks to Olivier for making the trip. It was incredibly hard for inclement weather and some bumps along the way, but we're very happy to have you here. For those of you that don't know Olivier, he's the Vice President of International Arbitration at CPR, a fervent advocate of international arbitration, which I know is near and dear to most of our hearts here. And as I shamelessly plugged to Olivier before when I saw him earlier, I just yesterday included a CPR clause in a contract as a thank you for including us here, but also because this is a fantastic clause. But with that, I'll turn it over to Olivier, and thank you all very much for your time and being here.
Thank you, Cisco. And yes, it is always, for some reason, kind of difficult to get to Houston, but I made it, so I'm very happy to see all of you tonight. And thank you very much for putting the CPR rules into your clothes. This is a very nice welcome present. So on behalf of CPR, I would like to welcome you all to this YDR seminar on managing international arbitration from an in-house perspective. I would like to thank our great panelists, who will be introduced shortly, I believe, for making the time to speak to us tonight, as well as CPR member Reed Smith for hosting this program, as well as the reception that will follow. And, of course, all of you for braving the, I understand, quite heavy Houston traffic for coming tonight. So thank you all for coming. As you know, CPR was founded 40 years ago by a group of general counsel at Fortune 100 companies with the goal of improving efficiency and cost effectiveness in dispute prevention and resolution. Today, the organization is both a think tank organization with over 200 members, which are primarily large corporations and big law firms or smaller firms actually serving these corporate members. What we do together is working towards that mission of making dispute prevention resolution more effective and more cost effective. And then the other side of the organization is an ADR provider with putting into practice what we develop on the think tank side, So we have mediation procedure, we have arbitration rules, both non-administered and administered. And if you're not familiar with them, it is time to get familiar with them. I believe that we have rules for distribution. They are in the back. So help yourself and become familiar. As Cisco said, they are becoming increasingly popular. I have a problem with my iPad, unfortunately, so I cannot tell you I cannot read my notes, so I'll just improvise. This seminar is basically, as you can see, YDR, which is our Young Lawyers Program. It's an important program of CPR to educate the younger generation of lawyers as to the corporate perspective to dispute prevention and resolution. We organize this kind of programs, which are a roundtable with corporate counsel, so that younger lawyers can hear about their perspective on dispute resolution, which they don't always get the opportunity to, and also an opportunity to network. The group is currently co-chaired by Alberto Ravel of ConocoPhillips and Dana McGrath of Sidley Austin in New York, and it is composed of a great group of young lawyers, half of whom are in-house with some of our corporate members, and the other half are outside counsel at our law firm members. And this group of people work together in order to organize this kind of events, but other events too, like MOSC. And also we have an award, a YDR award for efficiency between in-house counsel and outside counsel, which we started last year and which will have a second edition this year. And so I encourage you to join the mailing list and to stay abreast of what we do. So I said that this year is CPR's 40th anniversary, so we continue to innovate, and I'm just going to give you a few highlights tonight, if I can remember them all without my notes, of what we've been doing lately. Our arbitration committee has just released the CPR Corporate Counsel Manual for Cross-Border Dispute Resolution, which we'll be talking about a little bit more tonight. And that is a manual that carries out our mission. We have organized the first ever international mediation competition in South America. That was a few weeks ago on May 16th and 17th in São Paulo. The competition was a great success. It was the first edition, as I said, but we think that it's going to be continue to be a great success. It was hosted by our partner FIESPE, the Federation of Industries of the State of São Paulo. And as I said, was a great success. We have released not too long ago an international mediation procedure, which was drafted by our European Advisory Board, as well as our mediation committee. And that's a mediation procedure that can be used anywhere in the world. If you're not familiar with it, go to our website. There is a section with our rules, and you will find it under international. Two coming up events to close this very brief introduction. We have the next big event that is going to take place with CPR is our second Canada regional meeting, which will take place on September 19th at Toronto Arbitration Place. And then our Corporate Leadership Award dinner, which will take place, that has not been publicly announced yet, but that is going to take place in New York, I believe, on November 7th. And then our annual meeting, the next one, will take place in Atlanta between March 8th and 10th, 2018. So I invite you all to stay tuned as to these different events and to come to learn more about CPR. I'll be happy to talk to you, of course, afterwards during the reception about all of these initiatives and all the other ones that we have. But now I will turn it to Will, and I take also this opportunity to thank you, Will, for organizing the panel tonight.
Thank you, Olivia. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for making the time and effort to come join us tonight. We hope that we can give you something worth your effort. So let's set the stage first. Well, first of all, I'm Will Russell, as he mentioned. So imagine your client or your company just closed a wonderful deal, a far-flung country, foreign law, foreign culture, foreign business practices, foreign in every sense of the word. But nonetheless, the transactional team has worked diligently and hard to find common areas in the seemingly irreconcilable law and cultures and all that, and they've done a great job. Champagne glasses are clinking, people are celebrating, people are talking about the bonus from the league. We are not here to talk about that. That is when the wheels are being put off. We're here to talk about what happens when the wheels come off and champagne glasses are not clinking. So imagine on this transnational deal that you wind up in a foreign court that you don't know anything about, but you know that it has a reputation for being non-neutral. You know it has a reputation for having great delays. You know it has a reputation for not having the most expertise in its fact finders or its decision makers. What are you going to do about the counsel who represents you in this foreign land? How are you going to find an outside counsel that you trust? What if you wind up in parallel proceedings? You file in your home jurisdiction, they file in their home jurisdiction. Inconsistent results, double cost, double delay. What if you wind up, after all that time and all that money, with a judgment that's unenforceable because it doesn't have a treaty behind it? What if you wind up actually having an arbitration clause in that underlying transaction, but it's not right? What if you wind up in a situs, a seat of arbitration that's hostile to arbitration, that allows what we all have heard about guerrilla tactics to take place, challenging the arbitrators, arbitration injunctions? What about your client that winds up thinking that the arbitration process didn't deliver on the better, faster, cheaper that everybody told them that it was going to be, or her? What if the client is surprised by the judicial culture in that arbitration? You know, the exchange of documents, the way testimony is taken, the way privilege is handled. What if they wind up with an award that's unenforceable in the place where the assets are? So suffice it to say, transnational disputes and transnational transactions have a peculiar set of issues that are fraught with traps for the unwary. So fortunately, we have this panel of experts to guide us like Sherpas through this treacherous terrain and help us avoid all of these, every single one of these pitfalls. Time permitted. So I'll introduce them more detail in a second, but these are the end users of arbitration. There's something in here for everyone. There's something in here for our in-house counsel guests. This is the crew that does this more than anyone. These folks can tell you the best practices that they have forged through years and years of practice. For our outside counsel, these are your clients. These are the folks that are going to tell you what they are looking for from this process. And for our friends here that are arbitrators, these are the end users. If there are problems, these are the people who can identify what they are and what they're looking for when they're negotiating those clauses. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about who we have here. Let's start with Gene Silva down on the end. Gene is counsel at ExxonMobil in the International Disputes Group. He has been involved in many of the cases we've all heard about that should go unmentioned. So let's just say that his role is handling very significant international and investor state and commercial arbitrations. He's handled arbitrations under virtually all of the major arbitral institutions. He got his JD from UT. He got an LLM from the University of Edinburgh, and he is a professor of this subject at University of Houston. Next to him is Alberto Ravel, who we've heard a little bit about, one of the chairs of this section. He's the senior legal counsel for arbitrations at ConocoPhillips. He's also managed disputes that we've all heard about. And as Clyde, who's in here somewhere, I don't know where he is, but Clyde will tell you that Alberto has managed more of these proceedings than probably all of us put together. He was in the Caracas office of McLeod Dixon for many years, and he is the co-chair of the Young Arbitrators Group of the CPR. Next to Alberto is Teresa Garcia Reyes, who is senior counsel for litigation at GE Oil and Gas. She handles commercial and international arbitration, and as you will see from this panel, she has a real wealth of knowledge and experience. It truly is a blessing to be able to take in some of her understanding. She's also very involved with various initiatives within her company and in the community regarding gender equality and fairness and diversity and all those things, and we'll have a chance to talk with her in more detail about that. She's an Aggie, summa cum laude, and she went to Tulane Law School, summa cum laude. So welcome to Teresa. Next to Teresa is Liz Devaney, who I will tell you was in an improv comedy group. Charming people you will ever meet. So on the other side, she's senior corporate counsel for litigation for Occidental Petroleum. She handles a lot of these international arbitrations as well as domestic litigation. She was at V&E and Quinn Emanuel before winding up at Oxy, and she got her JD and her undergrad from UT at Austin. Okay, so Olivier, we've already met. Let's get right down to it. Let's start at the beginning. How do you handle that parade of horribles on the front end? You handle it in the contract. You handle it starting out, this is our submission to you, through an arbitration clause. And if there's anyone on this planet that knows how to prepare an arbitration clause, it is Alberto. Okay, so Alberto, let's start with the inception. When your client comes to you and is putting together a dispute resolution plan for a particular project, or even generally speaking, I think the first question you need to consider is the first fork in the road, arbitration versus litigation. Help us understand which fork to take.
Well, every time I get that question, I say that I'm a very lucky guy because you don't get asked that question very often. The way these contracts work in real life, and I know a lot of arbitrators here say, oh, there was a problem with the arbitration clause, or some practitioners don't like the arbitration clause that the parties negotiated, but that most of the times, dispute resolution clauses we inherit from a past contract, or we don't have a choice to negotiate a dispute resolution clause. It depends on the leverage that you have on the particular deal, on your authority to convince your internal client and the other side that the existing dispute resolution clause is wrong, or if you're in a setting where the other party doesn't care about the dispute resolution clause, which is often, you know, sometimes the case. But we found very sophisticated counterparts that insist on litigation for their for potential disputes on their contract. And that's not only the case for some host governments that are that have a policy of resource nationalism, for example, but also in very sophisticated, U.S.-based parties. So, again, I say I'm lucky if I can answer that question. But we do have a choice. We tackle the question on a case-by-case basis. You know, what is the underlying contract? What potential disputes are we anticipating under that contract? And based on that, we, for example, if we're in an international setting, we will almost every time go with international arbitration. We don't want to end up in a court in my home country of Venezuela, for example. So if we're in an international setting, we try to negotiate an arbitration clause. And then whether the clients accept or not that local litigation in the international context is ultimately a business decision. We as a legal department can tell them, you know, this will go south for a number of reasons, and it's ultimately a commercial choice. But when we do have a choice, we look at, again, as I was saying, at the particulars of the deal, whether we're dealing, for example, with a co-venturer or a JV partner. In those cases, we'll most likely end up with an arbitration clause because it's perceived as a friendlier setting. We can preserve confidentiality. Arguably, costs of litigation or costs of discovery are going to be lower than in litigation. So there's a tendency to adopt arbitration clauses for domestic disputes that are large and that are complex. I don't know if anyone else has a similar experience with that in the panel.
I will say on the international front, if we've got a state counterparty who insists on sort of local courts, we've had some success saying, oh, sure, we'll go to Lima if this is, or I say Lima, it's just a fill-in for insert foreign city here. If the dispute is, you know, $5 million or less, we'll do it in your home court because we sort of get with our business guys and say, how much money are you willing to, like, lose?
Yeah.
Not recover, I suppose.
We have had some success sort of bifurcating the forum based on dollar value.
We've done that, but when we do that, we are careful about, you know, who determines whether this is a $5 million dispute,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what we do, what we typically do in those cases is we would have we do that with also with like one arbitrator or three arbitrators on the dispute resolution mm-hmm. clause. So we'll say something like, if the dispute is, you know, on, in the aggregate of $5 million, or if there's no agreement as to the amount of the dispute, we'll go to arbitration.
Yeah.
So you have an out in case somebody disagrees with what the amount of the dispute is.
I don't want to get you out of sequence, but you mentioned confidentiality and enforcement, but you were talking in the context of domestic. Can people rely that arbitration is always going to be confidential, and can people rely that a domestic judgment will always be enforceable?
Well, no. thanks, Will. I mean, I think you're especially if you're dealing in an international context, I won't say there's a guarantee, but there's a likelihood that the confidentiality clause will be respected, at least in the arbitration setting, or at least by the arbitrators.
If you put it in there.
If you put it in there, absolutely, yes. And that's what I mean by having a confidential setting and choosing arbitration over litigation.
As opposed to private.
Exactly. Yep.
What about enforceability of an award?
So, you know,
or a judgment.
You know, it depends on whether, as you were saying in the beginning, whether there's an applicable treaty or not. When you're dealing with arbitration and when selecting the seat, and I know we're going to cover this in a minute, but you would go for a country or for a seat that, for example, is a member of the New York Convention. That will give you somewhat of a guarantee that award is going to be enforced in all the signatory countries of the New York Convention. So you're increasing your chances at enforcing that award, especially if we're dealing, again, in a weird jurisdiction or an unfriendly jurisdiction where the judgment, the local judgment, could be, you know, filled with irregularities. That's especially true if you're on the side. If you're on the defendant side, then maybe you may want to have a judgment in a weird jurisdiction to resist enforcement on.
Speaking of, reminds me, none of the things that our panel members are saying reflect the views of their companies necessarily. These are their individual comments. I promised them all that I would make that disclosure. These are individual comments and don't necessarily reflect the views or positions of their employers. So, Alberto, let's turn to some drafting tips. We've identified a parade of horribles and a group of goals. Maybe you could help us out with a few tips on how to navigate through those.
Yeah.
As our Sherpa.
So I was saying, you know, with just like the previous question on drafting, it's also a matter of, do you have actual leverage or the actual power to draft and negotiate the arbitration clause. As I was saying, we end up a lot with, can you live with this language? That's the type of question that I get a lot, you know, or keep your changes to a minimum. And so when we do have a chance to draft, we have an internal process, for example, that we try to funnel all of the dispute resolution clauses and arbitration clauses through one person. That person happens to be me. But I think that's a good advice for the in-house lawyers in the room. You know, have somebody within your organization that has the expertise to review those clauses. Don't leave it to the last minute. Don't leave it to the transactional lawyers. Or if you're going to have a transactional lawyer do that, make sure that the transactional lawyer is familiar with the potential pitfalls that a bad arbitration clause could have. So my first piece of advice is, you know, appoint a point person for that role. If you don't have that point person, or if you don't have that expertise, just go to outside counsel. And you know, any lawyer here will give you good advice on an arbitration clause within an hour. It's not going to be expensive, and it's going to save you a lot of money down the road. There are resources also that are available for practitioners. This corporate manual, for example, is a good example of that. It has good drafting tips on arbitration clauses. Some law firms have come up with guides on drafting arbitration clauses. But if you don't want to, if you want to play it safe, you can rely on a model clause created by one of these institutions. CPR has a model clause, ICC, LTIA, CIAC, all of them have arbitration clauses that are available online that are pretty good, pretty basic, but pretty good, and they work. And they're proven. And so that's a good advice. My advice is people a lot of times ask me for, our transactional lawyers ask me for a model. They want a model. Just give me a model that I can use for all my contracts. And my answer to that is always no, because models are very dangerous when it comes to arbitration clause. One, because not all clauses are appropriate for all contracts. There's no miracle arbitration clause or one-size-fits-all arbitration clause. You may end up in a case where litigation, for example, is a more appropriate venue for the dispute. Or you want a simple single arbitrator clause for a particular smaller contract, or you have an international contract that warrants three arbitrators seated in London or Geneva or Paris or God knows where. So second, the model I've seen gets a lot of improvement, and then it gets really dangerous. I've seen draft clauses that I've sent, they come around with changes that are frankly beyond common. So that's my advice. You know, you can have a model for a particular set of contracts, but having a model for a company-wide arbitration clause is, in my view, very dangerous. I don't know if you guys deal with that issue also.
I think where we get, I would just echo what you said. What gives us sort of the most heartburn is when people get too creative with these clauses. And while there's not necessarily a model clause that fits every type of contract, there is model language for certain types of contracts. We had an instance recently where, while they're supposed to come to litigation counsel when they do their dispute resolution clauses and contracts, they did not do so in this case. And unfortunately, outside counsel, who shall remain nameless, had almost a page and a half on their dispute resolution clause, and it inserted so much stuff in there that didn't need to be there, and it's going to be a nightmare if we ever have a dispute on that particular case. So I think I would say just when you're drafting it, keep it as simple as you can, recognizing, of course, that some of the clauses are going to be a little bit more complex than others.
Mm-hmm. So let me give you a quick example. I got a clause last week to review it was a simple crude sales agreement or something like that, and it was a party in Latin America and a Houston-based party, and the clause called for LCIA arbitration in London with an English law applying. Why do we want to go to London for this particular dispute that has no relationship whatsoever with use the LCA clause? Let's keep it local. Let's keep it domestic, or do international. Let's use the CPR international rules. Let's use ICDR. But why in the hell? And the other side was insisting on LCA arbitration in London. And we, you know, in that particular case, we had leverage, and we said no. I mean, but there's a lot of that, and that's the consequence of a model that somebody in that company had, and somebody told them you have to use this model.
I want to get your input from the CPR on this, and after that I'll go to Gene about structuring the deal on bits. But yeah, I know the CPR can assist in this.
Well, I mean, what my comment will be regarding close drafting is what we do all the time is actually to encourage lawyers, both in-house and outside counsel, to become more familiar with the different sets of rules, because all too often we find that people, even who are in international arbitration practice, you know, are not that familiar with the different sets of rules. And familiarity with the different sets of rules allow you to both be flexible about arbitration, because at the end of the day, it remains something that is really flexible and that you can tailor to your needs. So knowing and having that familiarity enables you to do that. And second, I think it gives you the ability to negotiate also, because if you know the rules, if you know the differences between the rules, then you can have a more meaningful conversation. There are differences between the rules. You know, we mentioned confidentiality. They are not all equal in terms of what they provide for in terms of confidentiality. Of course, the default selection process is not the same, and way too often, you know, I find that people don't know what happens if they use the default rules. You know, what happens if the parties cannot agree on something, whatever, you know, is it going to be decided by the chair, by the president of an institution, or that kind of thing, which people usually don't like. You know, the differences, of course, in terms of costs, you know, what are the administrative costs, what are the arbitrator's costs, what are the, you know, the different types of costs. So there are differences. And then So what we do, you know, is try to educate, you know, in many different ways. We have a transactional committee that is working with in-house counsel to try to find ways to communicate to the transactional lawyers, to communicate within the corporations, you know, the information so that they can be more thoughtful about their approach to close drafting. And avoid that issue, you know, the 11th hour drafting, you know, like rushing and, you know, doing something stupid. And then finally, you know, if you bump into something stupid, like you said, Alberto, people forget that they can wipe it out, you know, and they can enter into some sort of submission agreement and agree to use different sets of rules, preferably the CPR rules. But, you know, any sets of rules, really. And if you get into that kind of situation where you have to arbitrate a simple commercial dispute between domestic parties in London with the LCIA, well, that might not make sense, and so this is the time to change that. So I guess those are the things that we're trying to do. So, you know, getting people more familiar so that they can, at different times, you know, use the most thoughtful approach.
Before I get to Gene about bits, Teresa, what about escalation clauses? Would you explain to us what they are, whether you use them, whether you've had some good experiences with them?
Yeah, so escalation clauses, for those of you that don't know what they are, it just has various levels. So, for example, in a three-step escalation clause, you would have a requirement that when a dispute arises, you know, the parties have to negotiate in good faith. You know, maybe there's a requirement that the senior executives meet. And then if it's not resolved within, for example, 30 days, it will escalate to mediation, and it has to be heard by a mediator before a lawsuit or an arbitration can be filed. So on that note, we do use escalation clauses. While we do have some three-step escalation clauses in some of the contracts, we tend to prefer what I'll call the two-step escalation clauses, which is no requirement that the parties negotiate amongst senior management from the get-go, but more that, if a dispute arises, they can go straight to mediation. It doesn't mean, of course, that the parties can't negotiate before filing a mediation. And in fact, given sort of the commercial contracts and the customer relationships that we do have, disputes are oftentimes negotiated between the levels of higher management before it even gets to any sort of stage where somebody would want to file a lawsuit. So we tend to have very good success with our two-step escalation clauses. We get a lot of things resolved at mediation. For those of you who have heard me, my spiel on this before, we're huge believers in mediation at our particular company. So,
anybody else have any comments on the experience?
Just one that I typically see in contracts that we get, especially in just long-term relationships that we have with cooperation agreements with particular entities, and we have those multi-step clauses. What I've seen, ones I've seen with those clauses, is sometimes there's not a clear path between one mechanism and the other. So there's no clear path to from negotiation to mediation. So for example, the clause would say something like the senior executives of the party shall meet 30 days after receiving a notice of dispute and shall attempt to resolve the dispute. And so what happens if they don't meet? Can you go to the next step? And so what we usually try to do is tie every single phase, every single step to a particular timeline. So we say, for example, 30 days from the notice of dispute, you do this. 60 days from the notice of dispute, you can go to mediation if you don't resolve. So there's always a clear path, from notice of dispute or start of the dispute to your final dispute resolution mechanism, call it arbitration, call it litigation.
Gene, we were grousing about how we arbitration types don't get consulted enough on the dispute resolution clause. What about being consulted on structuring the transaction to take advantage of bilateral investment treaties, or multilateral investment treaties?
Certainly, my experience has been that we see a lot more of that. I think it's probably safe to say that it's not like investor-state arbitration was invented yesterday, but there is certainly much more visibility amongst the clients. The business people are aware of it. They understand that there is a way to hedge risk using treaties and other mechanisms as well, stability clauses or other structures that you can impose in the contract to provide some equilibrium, be it some sort of security or letter of credit or things of that nature. So I think they've always been very sensitive to the idea of balancing risk in the course of a negotiation, but I think they're much more conscious now of the idea of using something outside of the contract that they can control. It's not like you have to ask permission of the other side. Can we introduce my bilateral investment treaty into this contract? You can go and structure on your own, obviously within the limits of the law, and obtain that protection and have that additional that additional risk mitigation. Now, what comes with that greater knowledge and facility with those ideas is a corollary understanding that sometimes it's not all what it cracked up to be in the event. And certainly some of the decisions that have been made recently, some decisions we've gotten recently, might have soured some on process of souring people on the notion of bilateral investment treaties as a real option to mitigate risk. But as I tell our business people, in some situations, that is really the only option we have to try and at least have something on our end of the ledger. And even if it doesn't come down to you filing suit, pursuing the case all the way through the award and the inevitable annulment and then the enforcement process, at least when the minister of whatever hauls the local country manager into his office to harangue him about this, that, or the other, he's got something to say. You know, it's, well, look, you can only push us around so far. In theory here, you know, we can sue you. There are certain rights that exist outside the scope of our contract that are not amenable to local legislation and cannot be easily wiggled out of by the government. And bringing that to their attention can, at least in certain circumstances, help the conversation along.
You know, we all have our go-to books about things like arbitration. Let me pitch it to Olivia here for a second. Everything that we've talked about is covered succinctly in this book. So let me let Olivia, you know, give a bit of a pitch for the book, because I personally endorse it, think quite good.
Yes. So the book, which I mentioned before, actually has been drafted by our arbitration committee under the leadership of Ang Zantens and Jennifer Glasser of White & Case. We have a number of our arbitration committee members who contributed to the book, and it is really meant to fulfill, as I was saying before, one of the critical missions of the organization, which is to educate in-house counsel so that they can do a better job at dispute resolution. So it's not meant, I reassure those of you who work at law firms in the room, it is not meant to replace outside counsel, but it is meant to educate in-house counsel.
It is meant to
provide more knowledge to the in-house counsel so that they can work better and more efficiently with their outside counsel. So that's really the goal of the book. So the book contains everything you need to know, and you see it's not a huge treatise, so it's something that is very practical to use with different little tabs, with different chapters. And it is meant to, it covers planning across border disputes, so planning, negotiation, and mediation, considering whether to use litigation and arbitration, which is something that we've already touched upon, drafting cross-border multi-step clauses, providing for negotiation and or mediation before arbitration, and what to do so that these multi-step clauses can work effectively and not, stall everything down. Drafting expert determination and dispute board clauses, and, of course, drafting international arbitration clauses, choosing between ad hoc arbitration or administered arbitration, discussing, what you need to pay attention to as far as the seat of the arbitration is concerned, the language, arbitrator selection, rules, etc. So really all the key elements of a clause. Structuring foreign investment and also providing practical tips for managing cross-border ADR and arbitration while it's ongoing. So it's really a very practical book. You can order it on our website. It's only $99 for CPR members and $79 for non-CPR members, but believe me, it's worth the investment. That was a short pitch.
Yeah, very nicely done.
There's no sale today?
There's no sale, but you can go to the website to order.
Let's shift. So from the outside counsel perspective and from the arbitrator perspective, there's a limited amount of understanding that we have about the pressures and the deliverables that you guys face as in-house counsel. So what I'd like to do now is take a moment to sort of, you guys let us look behind the veil a little bit. Gene, you and I were talking about this. Tell us a little bit about, what you would want us to know about your deliverables, about your pressures and the things that you need to deliver to the people to whom you answer, and how that impacts how you manage your case and how you would like the arbitrators and outside counsel to be aware of what's going on behind the veil.
Well, I should start off by saying I will comment on this, except I will point out that these are obviously my personal ravings and things that happened in the context of my work. It may not be equally applicable across the board, but there's probably – we're not that original, so I'm sure there will be some general applicability. But generally speaking, there are I found it interesting when I came in-house almost 8 years ago, almost nine. It's shocking, really. I thought I understood what my clients, my in-house clients, were asking of me, and I thought I was delivering what they wanted. And it wasn't until I got on the other side that I realized that some of the assumptions that I had made about what they really wanted to hear or what they really needed was not really what they needed, or at least not what I needed. One of the big ones, and you can take this one too far, so there are some of you in this room who could take this too far. I'm really okay if someone shouts me down when I'm being an idiot. I'm frequently wrong. It's part of my charm. At least so my wife says. The fact of the matter is, especially early in a case, we at the company may come to an idea of how we think this ought to have worked out. It usually ends with us being right, just to be fair. But like a lot of people who are involved in disputes, you can kind of fall in love with your own case. And it doesn't mean I want to get beat up every time I get on the phone with my outside counsel, but it is good at the outset of the case to get that dispassionate, cold eyes review of the situation and say, okay, I know you guys think you did everything right and you did a lot right, but there are some things that could have been more right, you know, and identifying risk and seeing where there are real problems. It's not helpful to be all sitting around the table. Again, you can take this too far. And simply, you know, if the client shows up, if the business client is there and pounding the table saying, this is how it goes. I mean, there are ways to gently explain, you know, maybe, that's one way of looking at it, but it's possible that the arbitrators could see it a different way. That kind of early case assessment and that kind of honest assessment is something, certainly it's part of the ExxonMobil culture, that idea of getting, even internally we do it, getting cold eyes reviews, trying to get somebody from outside a situation to give you honest feedback and to look at things also after the fact and sit down and, you know, do the autopsy and figure out, all right, what went right here? What went wrong? What could we learn the next time we do this? It is a fairly dispassionate process. I mean, people do get wound up in their cases, and there are certainly clients and occasionally in-house counsel who get wrapped up in their own case. But for the most part, I think we do a pretty good job of trying to be open to that. And that's something in particular I think that we could take from it. I'm sure you guys have got ideas as well.
Liz, let me ask you, how important is the early case assessment to you guys? And when I say important, I mean how much are you willing to spend on it? I mean, are you willing to pay outside counsel to really go after it? Are you willing to hire an expert? Is that expert going to be a consulting expert or a testifying expert?
It really depends on the case. You know, if it's sort of a very technical, like environmental thing, then we'll probably get an expert very early just so we can figure out, you know, does it make sense to settle here? How bad is this? Are we responsible for it? But it's generally very, very important. And I will caution, though, against – I also appreciate counsel willing to tell me that my case is crap, but I have seen – outside counsel get fired because somebody got offended because somebody called their case crap. So if you're going to call somebody's case crap, you know, pick your words very carefully. You call it, you know, it's about a 50-51 on your side, Oxy. Close call. Because sometimes people really do fall in love with their cases, and they will get offended if somebody says, you really don't have a case here. And then they say, well, I need a new lawyer because that one said my case was bad. And then it sort of turns into this, well, if they don't believe in it, then they won't fight for it, and I need somebody to fight for my case, which I think is kind of bullshit. But I've seen it happen. So if you're going to sort of call somebody's case less than a slam dunk, you just pick your words carefully.
Teresa, Alberto, you guys look eager.
So early case evaluation is part of our process, and the good thing is that our clients know, our internal clients know that that's part of our process, and it's a very thorough process that involves outside counsel, involves the actual clients as well. So they're part of that discussion. So it's not only so they get to realize if their case is strong or bad, and you know, client over there can speak more than me on this subject because he came up with that process. But it's now part of the culture, and there are no surprises down the road because the key thing is outlining or highlighting or flagging all the risks early on. And so it's all about, you know, no surprises. You know, this could go this way, this could go that way, but at least you had a chance to preview how that really go. And that's, and the role of outside counsel there is crucial, as Gene was saying.
Teresa, any comments? Or is there anything that you wish somebody on the outside knew about what's going on the inside?
Yeah, just to tack on to the early case assessment, the only thing I'll mention is that for us, not only is it critically important at the beginning of the case, but we do oftentimes have outside counsel update the case assessment as it goes along. You know, because obviously when you start a case, your information is sort of limited and things can happen in the case that can change the assessment. So that's one thing to consider. The other point I wanted to make was tying off something that Liz said, is that we don't always want you to tell us that our cases are great. I, in fact, have, and there's a couple people in the room can probably attest to this, but I have gone out to outside counsel and told them the business is really gung-ho about this claim. I think it's a dog. I'd like you to take a look at it and give me an honest assessment. And a lot of times, once the client, the internal client, sees the early case assessment, they tend to back down because they know that a lot of work and a lot of thought has been put into it.
Shifting gears. Alternative fee arrangements. We've all heard a bunch about them. Very simple. Let's start with Liz. Liz, how frequent are alternative fee arrangements? How do you feel about them? And then we'll ask you some particular questions.
I will say, and I don't speak for obviously the entire Oxy litigation team, but in my experience at Oxy, we've done a couple sort of for smaller cases. I have a, speaking of inappropriate forums, I have a $6 million case that's supposed to be in the ICC in Paris, and it's nothing to do with anything in Europe, or, and it's $6 million. So we do, sometimes if we have a good relationship with outside counsel, we can go to them and say, hey, you're not going to, you know, pay the rent on this case, but please do us a favor. And they'll agree to sort of do a fixed fee with phasing and cap so that they'll, you know, they'll get some money off of it, but we know in advance that the $6 million case isn't going to cost us four or whatever. So we've done that. We've done some contingency fee stuff on smaller plaintiffs' work. But overall, we just have not really been able to sort of wrap our minds around. And I think part of it is the time limitation on all of our – everybody's so busy sort of doing the day-to-day that doing the legwork that is entailed in getting a good AFA situation set up just hasn't happened yet, although we're in the process of doing that right now with one particular firm on one particular sort of class of cases. And that even has sort of gone in fits and starts because there's homework on my part in order to figure out what's fair for us, what's fair for the outside counsel so that no one's ox is getting gored on this particular class of cases. And I think that's the biggest hang-up that we've had on AFAs is trying to figure out. It's just a lot of work on the front end, and we just haven't done and do it. So that is why I'm fascinated by what Teresa's going to talk about, because apparently they have figured something out.
Yes, that was a pitch.
very slow catch. So we're huge fans of AFAs. A few years ago, there was a little bit of a mandate that we get at least 70% of our matters on an AFA basis. For me personally, the goal is 100%. And so when I have counsel, when I have a beauty contest for a particular case and I ask counsel to pitch for it, I basically tell them,
If you're not going to give me an AFA, don't bother quoting. And an AFA does not mean a discount on fees. An AFA to me means a fixed fee, a cap fee, a success fee of some sort, a contingency fee, something that will allow me in the future to sort of forecast what my spend is. In sort of the economy and the market that we are currently in, obviously the business is very much looking to cut and control costs, and with litigation being such a cost center for them, occasionally we are a profit center, but very rarely, they're looking to sort of forecast that out. And so even if it is sort of on a capped fee based on certain assumptions, it helps the business to anticipate what they're going to spend. A lot of times outside counsel objects and says, well, litigation is so uncertain. We couldn't possibly know how long this case is going to take or how much discovery or how much, you know, what the experts are going to cost. And my answer to them is, well, do your best. Work in some assumptions. Work in what your assumptions are going to be. You know, how many witnesses, how many documents, are you going to be doing the document review or are we going to have an external vendor do the document review? Do you anticipate any sort of dispositive motions or issues having to do with jurisdiction? You know, if you're going to be handling the enforcement part of the case, what are sort of your assumptions there? And so build in those assumptions and make them strong, make them clear. And if for some reason, you know, something uncertain does happen in the case, which we've had happen before, we can adjust those assumptions. I'm not going to be a tyrant and hold you to them. But, you know, I do expect you to talk to me about it before you go off and blow the budget.
We've talked about incentive fees, negative and positive. We talked about success fees and things along those lines that you just told us a little bit about. What about on the other end of things, you know, the disincentives, the sliding scale of success fees?
Yeah, so I've sort of played around recently with, I don't know what you would call it, but an idea where you get a success fee for resolving the case, you know, whether it be by settlement or dispositive motion or some other mechanism early on in the case, and maybe I give you a success fee. And the longer that the case drags on, perhaps there is a disincentive to you, because a lot of times I think, not anybody in this room, but some outside counsel have an incentive to sort of drag on the case, regardless if it's an hourly engagement or an engagement by fixed fee or capped phase, in order to get the additional fees. Well, if there is a disincentive for the case to progress all the way through hearing, and you have to give me a very steep discount on either the cap or the hourly rate that you're charging me, there is going to be an incentive to sort of resolve it early, and perhaps our interests are more aligned. So we've been playing around with that here recently. The jury's still out. Hopefully we'll have some results soon.
So keeping with Teresa, you said something that all of us were quite fascinated to hear, and that is that you handle your own cases while you're working in-house. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the corporate policy that led to that and how it works.
So some of you may know my boss, Michael McElrath. He is a great thinker in the field, very avid poster on Kluwer, on OJMID, and other such arbitration sites. And to make a very long story short, he one day sort of figured out, hey, I know a lot about arbitration. Why am I relying on my outside counsel to tell me how to conduct an arbitration when, you know, I'm an expert in this? So why don't we start doing some of these? And what we have started doing and have been doing for many years now is a lot of our commercial cases we handle in-house almost exclusively. Obviously, if there's a big construction case or a case that's going to involve a lot of legwork, we don't have the bandwidth for that. But for some of these smaller or simpler cases, we do. And so we have started
not started. We've been doing this for a while, handling a lot of these cases in-house. So we'll do our own briefing. We'll do our own arbitration demands or answers to the demand. We'll do our own document review and production, because if you're under the IBA rules, theoretically, that document production should be limited. And if it's a straight-up case that is the product doesn't work, one side is saying it does work, the other side is saying it doesn't work, and it's governed by a contract, there's not any real difficult, heady issues regarding the law, and really not even on the facts. If somebody like me, who understands our product maybe better than outside counsel, has a better mastery of that.
Have you run into any problems on privilege or today, witnesses or anything like that?
Yeah, today we haven't run into any of the issues with regards to privilege. Because in essence, this hasn't been challenged yet, but we are acting as outside counsel. We're not acting as in-house counsel. We're actually representing the company in the arbitration. With regards to...
That's the answer to the question.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears a little bit.
Real quick, can I make one more comment? And I will say it's... Us handling it in-house is also a cost-saving mechanism. Not only are we saving outside counsel fees, but in a lot of jurisdictions, you can actually recover your costs as part of the arbitration. So if I'm handling the case in-house on, you know, let's say a $15 million dispute about a product, and I keep, a general idea of what perhaps my attorney's fees would have cost had I been outside counsel. We have had instances where the tribunal will award us costs, and so that allows us to recover a little bit more and be a little bit of a profit center.
Let's shift a little bit and talk about diversity. Diversity is a topic that's getting a lot of light these days and a lot of efforts to pledge. A lot of people are really focusing on it. Liz, let me start with you. So we have diversity issues with outside counsel, and we have diversity issues with selection of arbitrators. What role does diversity play in your legal department in terms of selection of outside counsel, selection of arbitrators, and how do you implement that?
So we don't have, Oxy, as far as I know, at least in the legal department, we don't have any sort of official policy on this. We don't track it. We don't look at the stats in any sort of official way. But our litigation department is almost entirely women. So we notice a lot. If you want to meet with us and you show up with like five, no offense to the old white women in the room or old white men in the room, but you show up with five old white men and say, we'd really like your business, we will listen to you and we'll probably have a polite conversation. We may even hire you, but we notice, and it's very obvious when we're used to being, I think women in this industry are very used to being a lot of times, especially in private practice, the only women in the room. So it's obvious to us when that happens, and it remains remarkable to me that no one thinks of these things sometimes when they come in to see us. But we definitely notice. We use a lot of women for outside lead counsel outside. A, they're amazing lawyers, and we go to them over and over and over again. But also, we like the idea that we're promoting women. And I myself, on a current class of cases where I'm negotiating with our outside firm to be sort of national counsel in a certain class of cases, I've made it abundantly clear to them that I get it. You're an oil and gas lawyer. You have a thriving oil and gas practice. I want to see more women working on my cases. I like the male associates that are on my cases. They're fantastic. They're great. I love them. They do good work. But I also want to see you doing what you can do to promote women who are interested in this, because I refuse to believe that there just aren't any. So I've made that abundantly clear. My boss supports me in making that abundantly clear. So we do pay attention to it, and we don't hire people because they are women, but if we find a woman we like, we're going to keep going back to her.
Well, you mentioned the way you put a little emphasis on getting the younger lawyers trained. That's a big factor, and that spills into the arbitrator analysis. As the outside counsel, we're always concerned about, you know, the risk. Candidly, if we choose a lawyer, we choose an arbitrator that is less known than the usual suspects. I think we all know what we're talking about. There's a group of arbitrators that everybody's always appointing, and they're way too busy, and they all, you know, and if we propose a less known arbitrator, you know, a woman or somebody else that is less known than the usual suspects, and something happens on the case, there's a lot of risk to us. So, you know, it takes a little guts on your side and on our side to appoint people that are not the usual suspects. Tell us a little bit about how you guys, you know, push the experience level forward, like you were mentioning with young lawyers, on arbitrators.
Well, we rely heavily on our outside counsel in arbitrator selection because, caveat, I did not come in to my job with any background in international arbitration, so I sort of came in without, I knew who, like, Brigitte Stern is or, you know, whoever, but I don't, you know, have the breadth of experience with different arbitrators. So we rely very heavily on our outside counsel. And luckily for us, they tend to be very open to appointing people who are not sort of necessarily the big names that everybody always appoints. And part of it, obviously, is the risk factor. You know, you can never go wrong if something goes south saying, well, we appointed the best known arbitrator in the world, and if something goes wrong, then you're kind of covered. And so I think whether or not it's outside, whether or not it's letting a junior associate sort of take a flyer on arguing a motion, or whether or not it's appointing a lesser known, individual as an arbitrator, I think it's going to be case specific. You know, it may not be the bet the company litigation where we take a flyer on a new arbitrator, and it may not be the motion for summary judgment that the second year associate gets to argue, but, you know, there are opportunities, especially in these smaller cases, smaller sort of things that where those opportunities come up, and we're pretty open to that.
Teresa, I know you have a process here and a lot to say on this. How do you and your firm work to your department work to advance the diversity issue?
So, I mean, I think for us, it's something that we always consider as part of the nomination process. When we're selecting an arbitrator, we're definitely looking for a diverse slate. A lot of times, if the arbitration institution is picking the arbitrator, it's one of the requirements that we'll put in there. You know, some of the institutions will do sort of a list and you cross off, and they ask you for sort of the qualities that you would like, and we always ask them to consider candidates from arbitral women and to propose a diverse slate. So it's something that we always do consider. The other thing that we're sort of, or I'll say that I'm a big proponent of, is a little bit more transparency in the process. I'm concerned about diversity, but I'm also concerned about sort of getting some of not the usual suspects, maybe the lesser known suspects, who are really, really good candidates, but they're not the Gary Bournes and the Jan Paulsons of the world. And frankly, I don't need Gary Bourne for my $2 million dispute. And so projects like Professor Catherine Rogers' arbitrator intelligence website is phenomenal. For those of you that aren't familiar with her project, in a nutshell, it basically takes some of the arbitration awards issued by arbitrators, sanitizes them, and gives you sort of a glimpse into what their process is. Another project that I'm very excited about, the author of the articles here in the room, Lucy Greenwood. but it's the puppies and kittens article. And basically, and Lucy can speak to this way more than I can, but it's a questionnaire. It includes a questionnaire about the case management policies of the particular arbitrator. If I have a glimpse into some of these maybe lesser known suspects, how they manage their cases, sort of what their approach is, I may be more likely to appoint them for some of these smaller type cases.
So I'll stop there.
Let's get Olivier to chime in here. I know that we mentioned the pledge, and I know that the CPR does a lot to advance diversity. Tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing.
Yeah, so we've been working on this issue actually since 2006 when we established our National Task Force on Diversity, which is not only a CPR task force actually, but you know, anyone, non-members included, can participate and, you know, join forces in order to work on some specific diversity initiatives. 2006, that was. 2009, of course, we founded YLER, which is a very important tool in order to promote the younger generation of lawyers and to give them visibility and exposure and, you know, to bring that new generation. So this is age diversity work. In 2011, we did a diversity pledge, which basically is a document that was signed by about 50 corporations, I would say, and that basically commit those corporations to nominating, whenever it's possible, depending on the rules, qualified, diverse, neutral, and asking their counterparts or their outside counsel to do the same. So that contributed to kind of changing a little bit and to start talking about that and trying to do that. I mean, it becomes complicated for a company that has signed a diversity commitment to cross over all the qualified, diverse, neutral systematically on lists, you know, if they have signed that document. And then last year, we signed the pledge on equal representation. Sorry, the pledge on equal representation in arbitration, which has been signed by many institutions, many law firms, and many corporations. And then I want to talk about a very specific program that we've been developing in collaboration with two organizations over the past couple of years, which is our diversity program developed in collaboration with LCLD, which is an organization legal Council on Legal Diversity, which is composed of almost 300 chief legal officers and managing partners at law firms, and FINRA, the financial industry regulation authorities, to try to we select a class basically of these LCLD fellows, and we build their skills. So they want to be neutral, they want to be mediators or arbitrators. We build their skills. We use some of our top-notch neutrals on our panels to train them on arbitration, train them on mediation. We use our distinguished neutrals to mentor them, to give them opportunities to shadow them, to work with them, etc., in order to build their skills, mentoring them, and also require them to attend a number of events so that they can also network and gain visibility and exposure. So this is a great program that we are currently having with these two organizations that we are possibly looking to expand to some other organizations. The numbers, despite all of these, you know, initiatives, are still not good. And I'll speak only for my institution. In calendar 2016, 26% of our panel of distinguished neutrals was composed of women and minorities, and 27% were actually selected in cases. So not the most horrendous numbers compared to some of the institutions that are out there, but still a long way to go. And my last note about this, because I know we have other topics to discuss, will be to say that there are other forms of diversity. I mean, we talk a lot about women, but there are minorities, all forms of minorities. Recently, I was on a panel last week. It was actually an international arbitration panel in New York. And we had the discussion, and for the first time, I think, ever in an international arbitration program, to my knowledge, LGBT was also mentioned. So there's all kinds of different diversity, forms of diversity, including also in the context of international arbitration, regional diversity. So, you know, there's still a long way to go.
Thank you, Olivia. Gene, we got 8 minutes left.
Questions.
And we got to leave some time for questions. We want you to bring us home. Okay. all disputes are a three-legged stool: liability, damages, and collection. And without any one of those legs, the stool cannot stand. Gene, tell us about how to view enforcement and collection on the front end.
Wow. 8 minutes?
In a left. You want to leave some time for questions.
So, right. So Teddy Roosevelt said it best, speak softly and carry it. Big lawyer. Look, obviously, the whole reason that, at least from my perspective, the reason you would ever engage in international arbitration is because you're looking for better enforceability. You're doing this because you need cross-border enforcement in multiple jurisdictions, or you need enforcement in a jurisdiction where you don't otherwise trust the local court system, either because you think you'll get hometown or because you think, well, that it'll never get done. The issue of enforcement has to be front and center, certainly in a commercial context, and it's something that we give a lot of attention to. The trick, of course, is there's only so much you can do beyond making sure that you have the right treaties that are applicable, like the New York Convention or other regional enforcement treaties. But that being said, you also don't need to limit yourself to just having the right treaty in place. The other way, I think, this is the way that our clients look at it, is you have to look at your deal kind of in the round. And there are a number of different things. You can't simply tick the box and say, okay, New York Convention applies. You know, sovereign immunity waivers are important. You know, stability clauses, obviously bilateral investment treaties and that sort of thing. But also deal structure in and of itself. And I've seen deals where we've had real issues with, where we thought, okay, we've got an avenue to bring the case and hopefully win, but the reality is we're never going to be able to collect. So how do we make it work? And one of the ways you make it work is to take that counterparty and link them to a different deal someplace else where you do have a little more leverage. And so you put cross-default provisions in. You do things that take those two projects and tie them together so that one doesn't stand on its own out there by itself. I mean, there are other ways you can deal with a collections issue instead of simply beating on each other until somebody yells uncle. Although I love that, don't get me wrong. But anyway, I think that gets us to questions. So
5 minutes left. Anybody else have any other comments? Anybody have any questions? Any comments? Shed a little experience from this side of the microphone, because I'm looking around and I see a lot of people with a lot of training.
Let me ask Gene a question. In light of the diversity conversation we just said, why did you say beat on them until they call uncle?
Fair enough.
I'll just ask.
Aunt, second cousin, distant roommate. I'll anything that involves a check, I'm good.
Lucy, do you have anything to add? This is one of the motive forces behind a lot of the issues and the diversity effort.
Yeah, I just think it's fascinating to have a session like this where diversity is openly discussed. 5 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. We focused on the underrepresentation of women, but Olivia's point is a key one. Generally, in the field, we have lagged massively behind flow beyond diversity, and diversity in its widest possible sense. So I'm just hugely excited that these type of events, discussions like we've had tonight, are actually being had, and hearing particularly how this is at the forefront of in-house chapters' minds is hugely encouraging, I think.
And if you look at the makeup of our panel, things are happening.
That's right.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you. One of the big criticisms of arbitration, like litigation, is that the expense has gotten way out of hand, and the discovery is too expensive, and too much length to go to federal court discovery. And as an arbitrator, one of the things that I see everyone's going to find counsel who come in, and they want to do thorough rules discovery and arbitration. So I'm wondering what kind of instructions or limits or encouragement you give your or outside counsel to prevent that from happening in order to facilitate the process.
So one of the things that we do, Bill, on that is on domestic arbitration clause, we put limits sometimes on discovery. You know, usually the applicable rules will deal with that, and if they apply the IBA rules and all that. But in domestic-type contracts where you're dealing with domestic parties that are very used to litigation, we tend to put, you know, limits on depositions, limits, specific limits on discovery, and that's a way to control that cost right off, you know, at the outset.
And going back to the drafting, this is also something that you can control, you know, during the drafting because, I mean, there are ways. I mean, this is the flexibility about arbitration, so not to be passive about it. The CPR Arbitration Committee in 2009 and the leadership of Larry Newman produced also a protocol on exchange of information and presentation of witnesses, which provides for different modes of disclosure, you know, from zero to full-blown American-style disclosure. So you can easily incorporate that into the clause. So, I mean, we hear that all the time, but again, you know, this is an element that you can control during the drafting process.
I will say that when it comes to domestic litigation, we actually have gone away from arbitration back to just a preference for just doing it in court. We've had good luck in arbitration, A, because we don't ever agree to sort of federal rules of evidence and discovery shall govern this arbitration. And we've had good luck with opposing counsel being reasonable. We've had good neutrals who, you know, tightly have controlled these things depending on the needs of the case. But as a general matter, if we can get in court, we just prefer that.
And I think that there is, you know, we've heard a lot of criticism of arbitration lately, you know, for all of these reasons. And this is what we've been trying to address, you know, in our administered arbitration rules, which you can find a copy of in the back, you know, cost, time, and sometimes lack of transparency.
I think the problem
see that, and then they go back to litigation.
I think the problem with litigators is that we all talk a good game about wanting to control discovery, but when it comes to, like, wait a minute, they're not going to give me all relevant documents, communications concerning the transaction. I mean, like, the second you're the one who's not getting the documents you think you're entitled to, all of a sudden you sort of lose your religion on controlling discovery. Sorry.
One of the questions that we put in our questionnaire was how the arbitrator approaches questions of discovery disclosure. Do you routinely grant your discovery just because the parties are asking for it, or how do you actually address this? Are you going more ideas and distribution questions now? We've had a mixed take-up to people's willingness to actually, you know, stick their necks out because some people were not allowed to answer it depends. But again, it's transparency, it's knowing your arbitrator before you get into the situation and to be able to actually try and predict a little bit how they're going to work.
But I was really getting this kind of philosophical end of it because when I started out, you have to just want making sure you don't overlook that one needle of a haystack out there that might just be the smoking gun. As opposed to balancing that cost against, you know, what is really necessary to
I'm wondering how
you
give guidance to your outside counsel to get them
where you want to go.
You
don't have a preference along that spectrum.
I let them guide me. 90% of the time, they know my case better than I do. So they're letting me know. And we have a very trusting, because we're very much repeat customers for our outside counsel.
Yeah, I think Lisa's right that it all depends on where you are in a dispute and whether you're going to have that philosophical thinking when you want a document that you know they it's a tough call. I guess
you know there's a figure document because you think there must be one out there.
Right. Yeah. So it's a lot of what Lucy was saying. It depends.
It depends.
That's your line, Lucy.
John, you had a...
Can I ask a question to my distinguished co-panelist regarding, because you know, I hear that on different programs, what do you think about clauses that are customized, you know, with very time, for example, requiring an arbitration to be done within, you know, 3 months or 6 months, because I've heard... General Counsel at massive corporations, saying, I don't really care what the outcome of a case is. You know, all I want is to put it behind us and so that we can move forward. Whether I win or lose doesn't matter, because if it lasts 3 months, then I'm going to, it's a business operation and it's going to cost me less than if it drags on forever. So we see also as an institution a lot of customized clauses requiring, very short deadlines. And as a result of that, in the cases in which we are involved, the average length is 11 months for an arbitration. What do you think of that in the context of this, discovery, disclosure, discussion?
I think those are helpful, but you're going to have to find a panel that is going to be willing to abide by those time limits. And then you need to watch out for whether having those time limits will impose a jurisdictional problem down the road if the arbitrators don't render the award within the specified time periods.
Well,
so that's my big fear. So I would love to include more of that, but I'm more worried about the problem that could cause.
I've seen it work, and certainly from a cost perspective, I think that's also a piece of it, because if you're billing on an hourly basis, if you limit the number of hours that can be billed, it does, without violating certain laws of quantum physics, makes it hard to get a really, really, really big bill. But the real problem I see is the aggressiveness by some of my clients to make the time period very short without giving any thought to the fact that the sorts of disputes you're likely to get will not be resolvable in 30 days with an award to be issued, fully reasoned award in 30 days and whatnot. And the problem is once you do that, then it's just kind of useless because everyone shows up.
Everyone
says,
waves the deadline.
This is
that's
ridiculous.
Stupid.
Everyone sits down and says, okay, first order of business, this is stupid. Can we get rid of this? Yes. All right. And then we stop this, but sorry. Something else. But the then there's no limit. And then it's like everyone feels, okay, let's look at our calendars. I'm good in 2025.
Right.
How about you for hearing that? So, it has its place, but it can be misapplied badly.
I will say I had one. It was a domestic case, and it was an expert determination, which domestically, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, it's a duck. So we actually ended up getting a very complex case done in, I think, about 8 weeks. And then our Harris County District Court judge would not confirm it. Great. But the arbitration experience itself was fantastic.
Three-legged stool.
Didn't get any money, but it was great.
Well, John, you had a comment?
So, obviously, I'm not a
in terms of the exposure of projects like arbitrator intelligence, things like the puppies and kittens type questionnaire will help that because I think right now at that level there is sometimes a lack of exposure because the big arbitration firms in town have sort of their usual, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 guys that they like to go to. And if clients, and I've been in this position before, right? I get a list from an institution and it has 20 names on there. You know, maybe I know 10, but I don't know the other 10. Well, guess what? The 10 I don't know sort of falls to the bottom of the pile.
or if I do any due diligence on them, it's calling, you know, my friends from private practice saying, hey, what do you know about this, you know, woman or this man? If you had something that made sort of characteristics and the preferences of these types of arbitrators publicly available, I think that incentivizes, well, not incentivizes, but takes away some of the mystery behind, okay, calling up, you know, ex-partner from ex-big law firm, and I'm going to pick on Lucy, unfortunately. Do you know Lucy Greenwood, right? Oh, no.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. You know, oh, no, I've never worked with her, but what about using, and I'll pick on Jan Paulson again, Jan Paulson for this, you know, $15 million dispute. Whereas if I knew sort of a little bit about Lucy, had a little bit of information about what her preferences are, I might be more inclined to appoint her for some of the cases. Not saying that you appoint, you know, maybe for the Bet the Company case, although Lucy is wonderful and I probably would. But folks like that, you start using them for some of the smaller cases and you get more of an insight into what they're capable of. And so later on down the line, it just increases the pipeline.
I would say that you should also consult the CPR panels of neutrals if you are a member, because there are 600 neutrals that have been carefully vetted for their commercial dispute backgrounds and their substantive experience, you know, dealing, you know, because we have 20-plus specialty panels, oil and gas, since I'm used to saying this, but banking and financial services, also an all-kind environment, you know, anything. And on these panels, you can search them and, you know, based on a number of criteria, and you will find those 26% of women and minorities that I mentioned before. And so I encourage you to use them.
And since I didn't do international arbitration in private practice, I very much gotten the impression that, you know, when I was in private practice, I traveled, you know, not infrequently, but it wasn't, you know, I have to go to Paris for 2 weeks or I'll be in, you know, Manila for 6 weeks for a hearing or sort of this very heavy schedule that I think, and I know I've talked to women who do this in private practice who said it was hard when I had kids. This was really tough and it required just a lot of sort of managing. So I think that in private practice, the practice itself can scare women away, especially women who are, you know, I had my first child in private practice and I didn't even travel and it was hard. So I think there's this perception amongst some people in private practice that, you know what, this is not compatible with where I want my future to be or what I think the next 5 years or 10 years of my life is going to be like. So maybe I think there might be some sort of opt-out. And I think firms could probably do a better job of getting women to a place where, you know, saying we can make this work. It doesn't, you know, if you're so scared off, talk to somebody about that and see how they've managed it, especially other women.
I move that we continue this discussion over some cocktails. Can I get a second?
Second.
Thank you all for coming. I hope it was valuable for you. Powers that be would the powers that be would like y'all to fill out those sheets. Thank you.
Good job.